I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. There's a fascinating and engaging book out now on organ donation, but other than statistics or research, which the book has, it also is the personal story of the author and her sister, Shauna Saunders, who was listed for a liver transplant, the only curative treatment for her end-stage liver disease, but who died waiting for a donor organ in 2003 at the age of 29. Joining me now is Anita Slominska, who has written Other Endings, Organ Transplantation and the Burdens of Hope. It honors Shauna's life by telling her story and narrates the agonizing wait for a liver and the precipitous decline as none turned up. The book began as part of Anita's postgraduate work in an interdisciplinary health studies program that researched organ donation. And it's not just the statistics of how many organs are donated, but the ethics of organ donation and the realities of how organs get donated. The fact that somebody has to die or be dying, and often in gruesome circumstances, gets overlooked when we're hearing of a gift of life or a second chance or even rebirth when a new organ is found. Anita looks at how often organ transplantation fails as well, and the reality that there are lots of people year after year who die waiting. It's a compelling memoir, raw and intimate. Anita Slominska is a postdoctoral fellow at the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center and the Institute of Health Sciences Education at McGill University. The book is published by McGill Queen's University Press. We spoke last week with Anita joining me from Montreal. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Anita Slominska. Dr. Slominska, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I was telling you just before we started that I found the book just incredibly moving because it's such a fascinating look at organ transplantation and what's involved with that and how we sort of misconstrue or have these misconceptions about it. But it's also the story of your sister Shauna and the end of her life, which in itself is such a moving story about what she went through, and then obviously your grief in terms of the years since. In terms of putting the personal story as well as say this look at the ethics and the sort, when did you know that you wanted to write a book like this?
Well, you know, I think that it started out, I mean, where I just didn't really know how to process what happened. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason why it was so hard to process what happened was because it was so out of sync, I think, with the way we usually think about organ transplantation. And it wasn't at all what I was expecting. And so I think just trying to get my head around what happened was really what, you know, where I started with the whole process. And so I didn't immediately think that I could even write something about it coherently, because I think it felt very incoherent to me. So it was kind of a slow process of figuring out how should I approach this and how should I even begin to try to understand her death and my sister's death and what happened to her.
Yeah, the thing that I was thinking about as I was finishing the book is we see you personally in terms of the growth that you obviously have managed to say, cobble through, if you will, over the last 20 years or so. I mean, there's a scene near the end of the book where your sister's in the hospital, and to go into the room, I think she was in the ICU at that point, you had to there was quite an elaborate getup that you have to put on, you know, in terms of scrubs, gloves and the sort, masks, and the nurse on duty says, "Oh no, you don't need to do that because she's no longer on the list." And I guess this is the first time you hear this, and it's such a painful, visceral reaction, and you know, understandable. And yet, you know, because it is. Well, I'm not going to try to prescribe what I think it felt for you, because you do that in the book. And yet, you know, there's this pain that's there as well, isn't there, for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mean, part of that incident, too, was so unfortunate because I think, especially now that I've been doing more research kind of in healthcare and healthcare experiences, too, I realize how important communication is in, like, a hospital setting. And, you know, that's not how that news should have been communicated. And I think that was part of what I was trying to communicate as well in describing the scene that way, because, you know, it's, and obviously, you know, nurses come in, they have their shifts, and, you know, new nurses come in and come out, and you can't expect a new nurse or any kind of new anyone on the staff to really fully understand a situation. So I think it was a situation where the nurse was kind of unaware of the stakes and kind of what we had been going through as a family, you know, through this whole process and how we had gotten to that point. And I think the fact that it was delivered, that news was delivered to me in such a cavalier way, was distressing at the time. It was very distressing. And I think it was kind of recognized and acknowledged as a as like not the best way. Like, not if there was any kind of debrief, which I know healthcare teams do that after that, I'm sure that would have been flagged as like, no, this news needed to be shared with the family in a different kind of way because of the implications.
Yeah, that made me think about, you know, in various situations that we all find ourselves in work and families and the sort, we know a lot of things that other people don't know, but now may not be the time to say, deploy that information, right?
I think there has to be some sensitivity to, what is, you know, how can really difficult news be conveyed to families, and what are the best ways of doing that? And so I think it was just kind of a miscommunication and a misunderstanding. But yeah, it was really devastating. And I think it was the fact too that I really was not allowing myself to think at the time that would have been a possible outcome. And I think part of what I was trying to write about, too, is that it should have seemed so obvious, you know, that, like, based on how things were going, based on her state, based on what we were being told, even though I think we were being encouraged to be optimistic, that somehow, you know, there was this a lot of denial, and some of it was denial, some of it was just, like, kind of refusal to believe that was going to happen. And so then it did give this very intense kind of unreality to what was happening at the time.
You do such a marvelous job in the book in terms of the writing and bringing us in. Because, you know, one starts the book and one can figure out, you know, that your sister Shauna, you know, has died. And yet when you write about hope and how... I don't know how to put this, because we all feel hope in various ways. Hope can be quite deceptive, and you write about the emotions about waiting for a transplant. And, you know, there's another scene in the book where there is a transplant that's happening with somebody else, but your sister Shauna is prepped as a backup because, you know, something could go wrong with the first recipient. And so they need to bring her in right away. And so one can only imagine what that's like to go through in terms of, say, just the waiting, the anxiety of it all, and in the end not getting it. And, you know, there are various moments where it comes close, right? And so as a writer, I mean, you convey that emotion to the reader because, you know, we're sitting there, you know, holding this book and wondering and hoping as well. But I guess I wanted to ask about hope and how you deal with that through this process. And I guess you learn a lot about it too, don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the hope that I think that is one theme, you know, that's kind of universal, as you've said. It's like we all experience hope in some way in different circumstances and situations. But, you know, I think it can be double-edged, I think, is also what I was trying to draw attention to, and that it's also really complicated. Like, it's you know, it's hard to, on the one hand, maintain a hopeful perspective while truly maybe acknowledging how uncertain your circumstances are. I mean, I think for transplant candidates and transplant patients, they really live that kind of uncertainty to a high degree. And it's something that's, I think in kind of all cases of transplant candidates, you know, when they're going to get a transplant, if it's going to happen, what the outcomes of that transplant are going to be. And so it's really hard to navigate. And I think, you know, with hope, though, hope is like, you know, celebrated. We celebrate hope. We turn to hope because on the one hand, it is really reassuring. And, it is something that is like, it brings kind of comfort or it makes us feel better. But I think, after I was thinking about it for a while and when I was trying to write about it too, it was like, it also has its downsides. I mean, I think the subtitle of the book, which is, you know, The Burdens of Hope, which, you know, I think it's about recognizing that if we kind of insist or if we demand of ourselves to have a hopeful perspective all the time, we might actually maybe be not harming, maybe harm seems too strong of a word, but there's like downsides to it, and I think we'll kind of suffer from that in the long run, having done that in the long run. And I think it's a challenge to even think about, like, or how do you balance hope with realism, you know? And I think that's something that's really difficult. And I think difficult in all, like, difficult just in general, you know, that an attitude of hope that, you know, a lot of people just want to have in their lives and in many aspects of their lives, but that can sometimes, you know, become disconnected from maybe the reality of whatever situation you find yourself in.
Yeah, that word burden is a great, it's used quite well in the subtitle because it is a burden, not just for Shauna, as we read in the book, but for you and her friends and family. I mean, to have to go through what she's gone through. There's a moment in the book where I guess you had found a book that she was reading, and there were, you know, she had written in the margins words like trope and the sort. I found that fascinating because, you know, you'd like to think that, you know, something that she's reading would bring her comfort or at least some information, but it wasn't helpful for her in that moment. I guess these were sections in the book that talked about a transplant being a gift of life or a second chance or a rebirth. Is that right?
I think I found that so interesting that she was writing that, and I think it's because there is this one kind of version of transplantation that's told, and that of, you know, this you know, the happy ending or the kind of resolution that comes.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and I think one thing that's always fascinated me is that, you know, to kind of make sense of experiences, we use stories, you know, to make meaning, or we use different kind of narrative elements to try to understand what we're going through. And we might not even recognize then how we might be kind of reproducing these, like, kind of typical or conventional ways of understanding things, just because it's easier in some ways, you know, just to kind of see yourself or see life through these kind of passed down ways of understanding what's happening. And I think, you know, in transplantation, I think it's additionally complicated because there is also this story that's told to kind of promote organ donation and also to validate donors. I think it's very complicated because I really support organ donation, and and I have a lot of respect and admiration for donors and families who donate, and, you know, and I think that, and that's, I do think that that's a very meaningful thing and a very meaningful act and a very generous act. But at the same time, I think the reality of wanting to, you know, support this version of organ transplantation to, in a way that's probably beneficial to donors, can maybe have the effect of silencing or putting some other aspects of transplantation kind of in the shadows, and then as a consequence, then I think sometimes organ transplant candidates or organ transplant recipients have to just deal with that privately, because there's a public face of transplantation very different, and then their own lived realities is something that they just experience as a private experience or a private burden.
Yeah, because there's a moment where the ideal candidate for Shono would be somebody who who'd been shot in the head, if you will, as opposed to, say, in any other part of the body, because at least you would know that the liver would be a viable candidate, if you will. I guess all organ donations have to come from death, don't they? And usually in gruesome circumstances. And I think that's something that we overlook, and that's something I overlooked before I started reading the book, where these come from, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think that's something, you know, like I cite a lot in my book the work of Margaret Locke, the anthropologist Margaret Locke, who has written about that in a very compelling way, too, that there's like this kind of way in which we're not acknowledging kind of the source of organ donation. Like, we talk about organ donation as though it's just, you know, this unquestionably good kind of phenomenon without really recognizing that it is someone else's tragedy. And also, you know, I think with, like, having, I know that I had this very naive idea that, you know, like, oh, yes, it's, you know, people die and can donate organs, but there has to be very specific circumstances,
yeah.
And most people who die do not have viable organs to donate. And, yeah, and that there is, you know, the kind of best possible organs available would be from young donors who aren't ill, so meaning some kind of accidental or you know, other kind of potentially violent death, and that there's no... That's really hard. It's really hard to kind of think about that too, you know. And so that's something that, yeah, I think is kind of glossed over sometimes, because it's not as comfortable to think about.
Another thing. So I asked you about finding that book, and Shauna had written all these ideas that she had about what she was reading. Well, what did you make of her turning to faith, religion, if you will, as she was going through what she was going through? Because, I mean, as you write in the book, you're not a religious person yourself, right?
But we definitely grew up in a religious household.
That's right, yeah.
So my parents are religious, and so she would have, like, already been exposed to religious ideas, and I think in part it was just because it wasn't something that we talked about, that was part of our relationship that we talked about those things. But in retrospect, I'm like, it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that there is a, you know, when you're facing, like, really kind of dire circumstances, that, you know, that you do maybe think about religion and more spiritual things, and that definitely is a source of comfort for a lot of people as a way to kind of make meaning of your experiences also. And especially if, you know, and to kind of circle back to this idea of, like, you know, writing tropes, like, if the rest of the story just seemed kind of empty or maybe kind of superficial, you know, to try to look for something deeper, to try to anchor what you're feeling in some bigger ideas too, I think is that's something that she tried to do. That was kind of her tendency, to have a kind of good intellectual grasp on what was going on with her also.
Yeah.
That was one of her traits.
Yeah, I think if I found myself in a similar circumstance, I would try everything or hope for anything, I guess, if you will, and turn to anything that, that might be helpful. A lot of the story takes place in the United States. I guess Shauna had gone to North Carolina for school. Is that right?
And so
you're both Canadian. The experience, though, in terms of organ transplantation, is that in the United States versus Canada, is that similar at all? I mean, in terms of the selection process and the sort?
Right, yeah. So I tried to explain that because there was this, because I do have a chapter in the book that's really about allocation policy, which is really focused on what it is like in the U.S., because that's where she was, and so that's where she was affected. But this this way of ranking candidates according to this algorithm called MELD, that was a policy that was also adopted in Canada. But as far as, the ways in which the wait list works in Canada, I guess I don't know enough if it's exactly the same, aside from knowing that they do use that that same kind of system of looking at those biomedical indicators and deciding based on a very limited amount of biomedical indicators that these are the best predictors of who is going to die before they get a transplant. And so that's been kind of embraced in North America as the best way of approaching organ allocation. But I know that there, you know, and then of course there's geography. That's always a part of it also, because time is important. You know, as soon as organs are recovered from a donor, they need to be transplanted very quickly because they start to. I mean, I think from a kind of medical perspective, they're getting a lot better at preserving organs and you know, doing I think I'm going to sound I hope I'm not saying the wrong thing, but I think they call it perfusion, like they perfuse or like they keep something, you know, like there's no more blood flow, but they keep a flow of some kind of substance going, so it's not like, so they don't start and they keep maintaining a certain amount of oxygen. They try to keep them alive, basically, like artificially keep organs alive in this interim period before they're transplanted into a recipient. And so that's why those factors are really important also. And so I think so for my mom and dad, for instance, they had a lot of they went through a period where they were like, should Shauna have come back to Canada?
Right.
Should she have come back to Canada? So they lived in Saskatchewan, and Saskatchewan doesn't do liver transplants, so the closest center would be in Edmonton. And I think there was like, should she have gone to Edmonton, and would she have received a transplant had she been listed in the Alberta transplant program? And so that's like one of those things that you never know, because it's just so hard to, you know, you can't kind of go down that path of saying, well, if we did this, then that wouldn't have happened. But that was something that was kind of considered in retrospect, like, you know, with the population in the U.S., which is a lot higher, you know, so the number of people listed for a transplant, where she was listed would have been a lot higher than had she been listed in Alberta, in the Alberta program. So it's impossible to say.
You mentioned something just now that made me think about the end of the book. There are a lot of what ifs, aren't there? And so how do you contend with that? I mean, especially me, 20 years later, you're still doing that, aren't you? Whether you should have gone to the Bay of Fundy that one summer, right?
Yes, so that's, I know, see, this is, I think that was where I was really kind of leaning into this idea, like, you know, like you, of these, of the narrative, these kind of narrative elements of thinking that there's an origin or a beginning of the story or something, and that's like, and that you can kind of, and that through, that, and I think the other kind of concept that I was kind of been kind of playing around with was this idea of causality,
and that things happen,
you know, sometimes they're kind of haphazard or random or circumstantial. There's so many things that contribute to why something unfolded the way it did. And so I think there was this idea that we always kind of clung to, that maybe there was this like very simple cause and explanation for all of Shauna's health problems. And so we just, you know, as a joke, we just decided, you know, well, maybe it was the Bay of Fundy.
Yeah.
And so it's more like a playful way of thinking about how, yeah, I think, I don't know that we would, I don't, that, yeah, that somehow there is, yeah, that there's some kind of, maybe there's just some simple explanation after all, when things actually just feel really complicated, and that there is no kind of easy answer or easy solution.
Yeah, but there's also a moment you as a parent have to contend with. One of the things that I went into the book thinking about, because, you know, when we think of liver disease or conditions involving the liver, we think that it may be brought on because one drinks too much. Another thing I heard, I remember reading this as a kid, or hearing this as a kid, that one took too much Tylenol. And this happens to you in one part of the book in terms of I guess you had given your daughter Tylenol, and then you worried that you'd given too much. So in terms of, I guess this is part of the what if part as well, isn't it? I mean, these things affect how you deal with managing pain even today. I mean, you know, if you've got Tylenol, because there's another scene in the book where she actually mentions that, doesn't she? That it's too much Tylenol that could probably cause some of this. That's what people think causes this disease, right?
Well, okay. The too much Tylenol thing is, so there was, and again, this goes back to when I was thinking, or when I was writing about, like allocation policy.
Uh-huh.
And there's this kind of special status given to candidates who have what's called acute liver failure. And this is like kind of rapid onset liver failure. And a very prevalent cause of that is acetaminophen toxicity, like people taking too much Tylenol. Too much Tylenol can, like, if you go beyond a certain threshold, you can actually go into acute liver failure from something that pretty much I think almost everybody has in their cabinet.
Yeah.
And so I think it's because, so then I think I think that was on my mind so much because especially at the very end, when Shauna, like, it was her last few days of life, I was feeling quite agitated and infuriated about this idea that there were these other candidates who were preferred over her. And that I know Shauna had kind of been, yeah, she was kind of like, yeah, people who take too much Tylenol, these are the people who take too much Tylenol. Not that we didn't have sympathy for them,
yeah,
but that it was kind of considered to maybe be like this kind of, you know, an act like a not very well-informed choice that some people were making.
Mm.
And so I think, yeah, so then I think with the incident with my daughter, when I actually hadn't given her that much Tylenol, I think what was interesting about it to me was this kind of, like, really strong overreaction I had to that, and I think because I was so, like, somehow all of this stuff that I wasn't dealing with, that I wasn't processing, that it was just kind of all came flooding back to me, and that it was really, like, it really impacted my behavior at the emergency room,
mm-hmm.
because they were like basically like, why are you here? Like, go yeah. away. Like, you came here for no reason. And, you know, and obviously overuse of the ER is something, you know, that I'm concerned about and I don't ever want to do, but I did that. And so, but that they could tell that I was really upset, and the extent to which I was upset seemed not well matched to what I was saying the scenario was, that I had just given my 2-year-old daughter too much, like, somewhat too much Tylenol. And so I think that's why I was kind of highlighting it, especially that I think that they suspected that I wasn't telling them something, mm-hmm. and that they were going to have to kind of try to, you know, probe a little more, like, why are you really here? Like, did something else happen? Like, is there, you know, was there, like, did she ingest something else? And you just don't want to admit what she ingested. And that, I think that was kind of the approach that they were taking with me, that I wasn't telling the truth. And but in reality, it was just like, oh, I had all of this buried stuff around potential liver failure.
Yeah.
And Tylenol.
Yeah, this goes into another part of the book that I think is incredibly useful, about what people should say to one another, because as you write in the book, there are many moments where Shauna, as someone who is sick, and you as someone who's around her, hear things from people that are examples of what not to say in a situation like this. I mean, people say the wrong thing, don't they, when in grief or prior to it, you know, when someone's really ill, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean...
That adds to the stigma of being ill as well, doesn't it?
It can, certainly. And I mean, I think one thing that I think I definitely noticed with Shauna is because, especially with young people, like young adults, you know, often illness is very unfamiliar. Like, I find the older we get, the more familiar people are with illness, and I think people are just more comfortable talking about it.
Yeah.
But I think she avoided talking about it because she could sense that it made other people uncomfortable or it made other people not know what to say. And so as a result, she didn't want to talk about it because, yeah, I guess I feel quite strongly that then that becomes this kind of burden placed on people who are the ones who are in fact ill, where they kind of have to protect healthy people from feeling bad.
Yeah.
Like I think that's something that's, and I think it's definitely still that way too, even though I think, you know, there is maybe a little more awareness and sensitivity than potentially in the past, but I think it's still something that makes it hard. I mean, and I understand that, you know, sometimes people don't know what to say, and that's, you know, and I think that's just because it's unfamiliar,
yeah.
You know? And I felt that way too. Like, I think I tried to explain a little bit too in the book that I didn't feel connected to what she was going through, as, you know, when, especially, you know, like when it was first happening, and I was only 10 years old, she was 11. Like, it was, I didn't know how to behave, like what I was supposed to do. What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do? It wasn't obvious I think it does kind of throw people off and kind of what kind of, I guess, like, quote-unquote, normal kinds of social and interactions or family dynamics or family interactions are really disrupted by illness.
You've done a marvelous job in terms of not only telling her story, but your story as well. As you write early in the book, you know, statistics aren't stories, and you've done a marvelous job in terms of telling us about Shauna. I'm really glad to have read the book because it's a way to have gotten to know her. I mean, I probably would have asked her what she thought of the Meech Lake Accord and federalism in Canada today, but, you know, because, you know, as you write in the book, she would have written the story herself had she survived, right?
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, yeah, no, I know. That's why it feels like such a huge loss. Also, you know, and I feel like, yeah, and I felt like recognizing the fact that I'm telling this, but it's her story, and I wish that she could tell it. Like, I absolutely wish that she could tell it, and of course it would be very different than what I wrote, but I think that, you know, I tried really hard to, like, like, I thought about her a lot as I was writing this, like, is this right? Like, is what would she think of this? What would she think if I was writing this or saying this? And I just, like, I was seeking, I think, her approval almost, you know, like, imagining, like, would she approve? Would she approve of me writing this? Would she approve of me saying this? And because that was also kind of the dynamic that we had as sisters. I mean, she wasn't that much older than me, but she was very much the older sister, yeah. And had, you know, and she knew more than me, and she had, like, better ideas. Like, she was the one who had, yeah, she was the leader, and I was the follower. So in some ways, I had a little bit of that as I was writing. You know, I was still looking for her leadership, which I think I do in my life kind of in general. You know, she's become this, like, person that I think about, like, yeah. Well, what would she think of this? What would she think of me doing this or saying this? And, yeah, and wanting to kind of please her, I think, even now.
Yeah. I so appreciate your time. I've kept you longer than I said I would. I could talk. Many things to talk about in terms of this book, and I urge people to pick it up. Thank you for your time today, and continue good luck with the book.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and thank you for saying those nice things about it, and it was great talking to you.
The book is called Other Endings, Organ Transplantation and the Burdens of Hope. It's published by McGill Queen's University Press. Its author, Anita Slominska, joined me on the line from Montreal. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.